Welcome to the Majlis, podcast of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project at Queen's University. Majlis is the Arabic word for an assembly, literally a gathering of people sitting together, and it was used for the sessions of learned scholars, philosophers, intellectuals, and artists brought together to discuss and debate. Our podcast intends to accomplish the same purpose of bringing together experts and scholars for discussion and conversation about the politics, histories, cultures of the Middle East, Islamic world, and Muslim diasporas.
You can find the Majlis on your favorite podcast site, including Spotify and Apple iTunes. Don't forget to subscribe and let us know what you think by giving us a rating.
Salam, hello, bonjour. I'm Adnan Hussein, host of the Majlis and director of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project here at Queen's. And it's a very special and sad anniversary at the time of recording. We had another similar kind of episode on the 20th anniversary of the Afghanistan invasion. On the eve, essentially, of the U.S. withdrawal after 20 years, we discussed the consequences, the history and consequences of that U.S. war and U.S. and NATO war. And, you know, to take us through another one of these sad anniversaries is Dr. Ariel Salzman, friend and colleague, professor in the Department of History here, Ottoman, Middle East, and Mediterranean historian. Ariel, it's great to have you back on the Majlis.
Thank you, Adnan. You know, again, a tragic event to commemorate, but necessary to have this discussion.
Yes, and there's been a lot of discussions about, you know, reflecting on the Iraq start of the Iraq War 20 years ago this month. In 2003. But there hasn't been a lot of real inquiry on the reasons, the rationale for the war, how this all unfolded, and a real critical sense of the history of that time. There's been a lot of discussions about, you know, consequences, which we will get to. But I wondered if we could just start a little bit with the history of what happened. Why did we get into, you know, why did the United States invade Iraq?
Well, you know, I think that what's happened too is that we've sort of agglomerated Iraq with Afghanistan. They're two very different things. I mean, and we know that really the morning after, or very shortly after the bombings, the plane crashes in New York City, in Washington, in Pennsylvania, that this group around George W. Bush had gotten together and say, okay, now we move on Iraq. So the planning began. It was not in any way, could not be described in any stretch of the imagination as having to do with what happened. It was not defensive, even though we can, you know, definitely say that what happened in Afghanistan was far beyond the sort of police action that should have taken place if it was to go after the culprits behind those attacks. But instead, it was there in the background, and it was part of a larger plan to, in this period where China's just taking off or just beginning, Russia is still pretty much on its knees from the neoliberal reorganization of its economy, you know, destruction of its economy. And there's this moment in which this group that's behind Bush are hoping to just dominate the world. And one way to do it is, of course, commandeer the world's, you know, main oil sources. Now, I don't believe that, you know, a lot of it had to do with sort of revenge for Papa Bush and an attempted assault on, you know, assassination attempt. I really think it was much more a comprehensive, opportunistic notion, coupled with people like Wolfowitz. Remember Wolfowitz, who was very much influenced by Bernard Lewis, and Bernard Lewis talking about very consciously thinking, you know, where did the British go wrong? Well, you know, here's going to be an opportunity to bring democracy, you know, transform the region, probably, you know, with the idea to the benefit of Israel. So Iraq's one of the last standing defiant states. It's not, it's very secular. Its background is in this Ba'athist tradition. So it has absolutely nothing to do with these new movements that are on the scene, these transnational movements like Al-Qaeda, no connection whatsoever, but defiant to the U.S. project. To see that opportunity, to seize that opportunity to remake the Middle East. And this was very deliberate. But of course, that was never communicated to the American public, because the American public from the very beginning were led to believe that there was some unholy relationship between Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and the Ba'athist regime in Iraq, which was preposterous for any one of us who know something about the region and its politics.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, that was a key feature in that period where the neocons and their ideology were really triumphant in determining the discourse, playing upon the, you know, understandable fears that the U.S. public had in the post 9/11 period. So they, you know, capitalized on that and sidelined genuine kind of expertise, both within the government and outside the government in academia and other policy circles, in order to promote these rationales for the war about the association between radical jihadist transnational networks and these nation states that were, as you point out, resistant to the U.S. project in the region, were threats to, their sense of regional security, i.e., you know, privileging, you know, Israel's dominant position in the Middle East, also as a frontier state in the global war on terror. One other thing that I think is maybe worth, you know, mentioning in this context as well is, you know, which was said at the time and was dismissed, is, you know, the rallying cry for those who were resisting and protesting was no blood for oil, at the time, that was seen as a very crude, pardon the pun, kind of materialist position. And of course, this had nothing to do with that. It was about, you know, democratizing, you know, the Middle East. It was about U.S. national security against, you know, these threats. It was against, you know, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction as a global kind of concern. And so this basic material kind of point about what was significant or important about the region geostrategically and economically was buried at the time, or sidelined and marginalized in discussions.
I think we have to be careful just about that, because I think obviously the oil was all about it, and it was all was in the mix from the beginning. But how it was, you know, first of all, it was a selling point, right? This war is not going to cost us anything. It's all going to be paid for with the oil revenues. You know, the Iraqis are going to pay for it out of their own pockets. Not a problem. But I think that there's
like the Mexicans will build the wall, right?
Exactly. So, but, you know, but it's also because, you know, the people who were involved in these neocon networks, you know, had this complete alliance between the military industrial complex and the, you know, fossil fuel energy sector. And they just come together like that. So it was profit from that perspective as well. The U.S. Army was becoming more privatized, you know. Yes. And so Halliburton, in which Cheney was a former CEO or, you know, on the board of trustees or whatever, of directors, he was, you know, all of his friends and cronies were in line to profit from these wars, you know, whether they made money in oil or whether they made money in building, housing for the military on the bases, because there's so much privatization going on. So that's the other thing. And then finally, you know, I think we always have to underscore the fact that the U.S. doesn't need Middle East oil. but it does need to control Middle East oil.
That's
because
right.
controlling Middle East oil controls the economic development of China and of Europe, right?
Yes.
So that's the whole thing. So it's control of those resources as opposed to, you know.
Yeah,
and
the U.S. is actually the biggest global producer
of natural gas.
I think also of oil, actually, now. So the point is that it wasn't because they needed to have that oil, but that, you know, they were swing producers, and particularly, you know, for, you know, Far East and Europe, that's where they got their oil. Yes. Yeah. Well, you mentioned, we've been talking a little bit about these neocons and their influence here on the Bush administration as the chief architects and ideologues of his foreign policy and of the whole global war on terrorism, as well as the invasions in Afghanistan and Iraq and planned invasions elsewhere throughout the region.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what's interesting, it seems to me, is that none of these people have paid a price, far from, you know, maybe the war crimes that, you know, many would charge them with. They haven't even paid a kind of political or career price. You know, these people, despite the disasters of their policy and the chaos it's sown, and we'll talk a little bit more about those consequences, they nevertheless have not you know, found themselves in the wilderness politically, but many of them have found their way back into administration, and certainly none of them have been disgraced. And even, of course, the president himself, George W. Bush, in, you know, contrast to Trump, who, you know, once Trump was being demonized, suddenly there was interest in rehabilitating, you know, George Bush as a kindler, gentler, in the words of his father, conservative. You know, what's happening there? I mean, this is a really strange.
Well, you know, I mean, there are have been attempts, and people like Rumsfeld, you know, now dead, and Cheney and Bush actually cannot travel freely because there is concern about that. Not that George Bush, W. Bush, was ever a great traveler. I don't think he'd ever been beyond Mexico before he assumed the presidency. But the fact is, they have been completely, there's been complete impunity. There has really not been a thorough study in Britain. As you know, Gordon Brown ordered a study of what happened under, you know, Bush's comrade in arms, Tony Blair. And that Chilcot report came out in 27 years later, but at least held people accountable. That has never happened in the U.S. The other side of this is that the Bush administration explicitly declared a policy that was a war crimes policy. It was a crime against the peace, as it was called, in Nuremberg and Tokyo in 1945 and 1946. A crime against the peace was the planning of an aggressive war that violated treaties. So this is a war crime. I mean, it's the highest war crime. It's the crime of, you know, the Emperor of Japan and that government and the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what they actually carried out. But they carried out blatantly by announcing that they had this new Bush policy called war's preemptive warfare,
mm-hmm.
that they were allowed to decide anywhere in the planet that there was a potential threat somewhere down the road to the U.S., and this enlarged version, or sort of, you know, completely distorted version of part of the UN Charter, declare it as a self-defensive war in advance, you know, of any threat manifesting itself. And so therefore, you know, they could concoct this story of weapons of mass destruction, which again went against all the inspections. Iraq was the most inspected country on the face of the earth. It had been under sanctions for over 10 years. Its army was completely degraded. You know, it was like 40% of, you know, what it was in 1991 during the first U.S. Gulf War, Iraq War. So, I mean, there was nothing there. I mean, they made it up. They presented it to the world. And then they scared the American public, you know, with people like Condoleezza Rice talking about a mushroom cloud rising over New York City, remember? Right. And if we don't do something now, we have to do something now. And then, of course, you know, this crazy connection between Ba'athists and Islamists, which was not there at all, which, you know, became a self-fulfilling prophecy. They made it happen, you know, subsequent to the war, you know, after the war started.
Yes, yes. So. And listeners, if you're interested in an account of the history and, you know, details of the sanctions on Iraq, you can check out an episode on another podcast I'm involved with, Guerrilla History, as part of our Sanctions as War series. We have an episode on specifically the Iraq sanctions. Well, let's talk about Iraq. Iraq today, 20 years after. What can you tell us about the conditions and consequences on Iraq of this horrible, you know, devastating 20 years?
Well, 20 years of political instability, continuous war, sectarian war, genocide against, you know, peoples under ISIS, the Yazidis, and just recently, you know, the change of government, the last government represented by the handpicked, you know, prime minister for the Americans who was supposed to clean up corruption. His name was Mustafa al-Kadhimi, and, you know, he proved to be more corrupt. You know, he walked away with $2.5 billion and, you know, tortured his opponents, arrested them. And of course, before he came to power, so that was 2020, it was after following this upheaval, you know, with massive demonstrations that were put down ruthlessly, you know, with the aid of Iraqi militias. So, and after months of stalemate in Iraq, he's been succeeded by yet another prime minister. Nothing works in Iraq. Corruption is rampant. The country is one environmental devastation zone, one brownfield after the next. People are suffering from all sorts of the effect, the ravages of climate change, but also the residue of these wars, which has destroyed the natural environment, left behind munitions, unexploded munitions, because the U.S. used all sorts of illegal weaponry, phosphorus bombs. They used cluster bombs, a variety of cluster bombs, so those are unexploded. And they used depleted uranium weapons. And those have left behind, of course, you know, radioactive pollution. And cities like Fallujah, which were devastated, there were several wars, house-to-house fighting, hundreds and hundreds of civilian casualties at the very beginning because it was a Sunni, predominantly Sunni area that was had stronger backing for the Saddam Hussein regime. Those areas have just witnessed incredible, you know, medical conditions. Birth defects are rampant in Fallujah. And so we're seeing generation after generation suffering from the effects of the war. Plus this society that's been torn apart, a society that had universities in which women participated at every level, you know, has because of this upheaval, because of this violence, because of militias that continue to basically provide security and as well as terror around the country. You know, the society itself has been torn apart by these years of war and what followed. Because when the U.S. went in on top of everything else, bombing, you know, with huge bombs that destroyed, you know, entire apartment complexes, they had no post-war planning. They had, for ideological reasons, they had decided there was no post-war planning needed. And I believe you remember that right after the war, you know, the initial days of the war where they declared basically, especially in Baghdad, that they had succeeded in defeating whatever was left of Saddam Hussein's army. The only building that they decided to put security around was the Ministry of Oil, mm-hmm. of Petroleum. Mm-hmm. Every other building was left unsecure in a country where people are desperate, where people don't know what's going to happen the next day. And all of the government hospitals were looted, as well as the museums, as well as Baghdad's famous libraries and archives were going up in flames and were looted in these days following the war because of the abject, absolutely inconscionable lack of planning that was deliberate on the part of...
Yeah, deliberate and utterly hubristic. I mean, there was also, you know, this idea that you could just dissolve the Iraqi army. You know, why pay
But you could dissolve the Iraqi state.
Yeah, the whole Iraqi state. But I'm saying, like, even from a military perspective, you know, to dissolve the Iraqi
army. Yeah, but that happened afterwards. Yeah, that you're going to do this de-Baathification.
Right.
Which basically meant that the entire professional class was pushed out of work. Doctors, lawyers, scientists, teachers, they were all kicked out of their jobs.
Yeah.
And then along with that was the military.
Right, right. Well, exactly. Like any government-based employment, because of course these were neoliberals as well as neocons, as you were pointing out before. And so they didn't believe in, like, you know, bureaucracy, state, you know. They wanted to get rid of all of these state employees, you know, let the free market, you know, take
the free market. But also, you know, it was this crude version of what happened in Germany, right? Mm-hmm. We had the denazification, which was never complete. They were practical. Yeah. You know, they realized the country wouldn't run if, you know, everyone who was a member of the Nazi party was gotten rid of. And it was even worse than, you know, in Iraq, or at least as bad, where you had to be a member of the Baath, you know, party. So you were a card-carrying member of the Baath party, it didn't mean anything, didn't mean particular loyalty. It's something you had to do. If you had a job, you were a member of the Baath party.
Right, right.
So, they got rid of the whole class, and society ceased to function. The government ceased to function. The court ceased to function. The hospitals, you know, the schools, everything ceased to function. And there was no thought given to, you know, what was going to happen. Had this viceroy, right, who was installed, who was straight out of the private sector. Right?
Bremer,
yeah.
Paul Bremer.
You know, who just said, snapped his fingers and said, no more military, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and sent, you know, what was it, hundreds of thousands of men off with their guns.
With their guns, yeah.
And no jobs and no way to feed their families.
Right. And then... lo and behold, an insurgency emerges.
Yeah, an insurgency. Where did that come from? Yeah.
Goodness, yeah. Well, I know, like, you know, if we wanted to put specifics to some of these consequences 20 years on, that there is an important documentary project, The Cost of War at Brown University. What do they have to tell us about the fiscal and human costs of the Iraq War since 2003?
Yeah, I mean, they really have to be complimented because they've been very diligent doing this. It's been led by Netta Crawford, who's used to be, I think, in teaching at Boston College and now is at Oxford. And so, you know, they put together a tremendous amount of information, but very conservative. They tried to, you know, get the most authoritative and to some degree narrow. But what we can glean from that is at least the war in Iraq, if you separate it off from the rest of the war on terror, the estimates are $2 trillion have been spent. And that somewhere in the neighborhood of 15,000 U.S. affiliated, so 7,000 soldiers and 8,000 contractors. Now here, that's very important because they always separate out the contractors, and that's precisely the point of privatizing the military, is that you don't have to worry about public opinion because people have signed on. You know, it's not someone's kid who's going off to get killed. It's a private contractor. And so they've put the contractors' deaths are a higher number in Iraq than the soldier deaths. But of course, that doesn't account for the thousands of people who've been injured, and injuries, at least on the American side and the coalition side, are very, very severe. They're not the kinds of injuries that people had in Vietnam, because if you were injured you know, in a very serious way in Vietnam, you died. Mm-hmm. But the nature of warfare has changed, and so people are wearing armor and body armor and stuff like that. And so the injuries are extremely severe, you know, loss of limbs and, you know, head injuries and stuff like that, but people survive. So there's also, you know, in terms of U.S. costs, and these are a fraction of what the Iraqis have endured and will endure because of the war. The costs are projected, you know, well into 2050, mm-hmm. because you're talking about healthcare and support for injured veterans, right. whose suicide rate is 4 times that of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The Iraqis, of course, have suffered disproportionately. So we're talking total of contractors, dead and soldiers, like somewhere around 15,000. Iraq is at least 300,000, if not 500,000, directly killed by the war. Now, again, this is disputed because the cost of war project takes the certified deaths to the extent that they can find actual documentation, whereas two studies, very important studies by The Lancet, which is a very prestigious medical journal from Great Britain, have done studies that estimate well over 1 million deaths as caused by the war. And this is because they were able to estimate on the basis of what normally would occur in terms of the rate of mortality in a society, and they see how much was excess of that normal rate. And that excess rate leads them to a much, much higher figure, at least double, if not more, than those deaths which have been documented, which end up in the morgue and someone writes down the names. So I think we don't know. And then there are, of course, these longer term casualties. We don't know, you know, how many people suffered. They were injured during the war and they died, you know, much, much long after. Rising rates of cancer. And I mentioned in cities like Fallujah, you know, extraordinary rates of congenital disorders in children and newborns, just horrific. And there's been teams down there just documenting what's going on. And of course, it's because of the munitions and it's because of the depleted uranium and the phosphorus and everything else that women are having children with just terrible birth defects or very high rates of miscarriages and, miscarriages.
And also, I mean, one thing that's useful about the excess death methodology is that it helps also capture, you know, the kinds of problems that come from the destruction of sanitation systems and various diseases, degrading of like the healthcare system for, you know, ailments that could have been easily treated. And so that's one of the important things is that it kind of helps account for the chaos and destruction. And particularly, as you were pointing out, because one of the consequences of the U.S. invasion and the lack of planning, as well as the ideological orientation of those who were, you know, conducting the war, was this destruction of the Iraqi state. It meant all of these kinds of institutions.
Yeah, it meant destroying the infrastructure.
That's
right. Yeah. Deliberate destruction, you know, and that was what it said, bomb them back to the right to the Stone Age.
Right.
So infrastructure was always targeted, you know, for the double reason, you know, because there was profit in rebuilding it. That was the other side of the profit system, mm-hmm. was rebuilding a country that you've destroyed and making them pay for it, you know.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
The casualties, you know, when you talk about the material casualties, the infrastructural casualties, the institutional casualties are just incalculable. And that escapes, of course, the sort of strict accounting method used in the cost of war.
Right, right. One other consequence I wanted to have you reflect on with me as well is kind of follows also from the political ramifications of this plunging of the country into chaos. The development of an insurgency and resistance that continued, you know, active conflict for a long period of time, but also because it's so weakened the Iraqi central government that it did lead to, the creation, and you could really say, of organizations like ISIS, movements like that, that, have also been very consequential on Iraqi society and polarization and perpetuating, conflict and bombings, and even after most of the U.S. Active military troops had been evacuated, that there are legacies politically and socially that have been affecting society dramatically afterwards, even when the so-called, invasion was over.
Yeah. Well, I just want to point out also to listeners that to take a look. I think the Guardian has just recently done a sort of video version of it on this little known history of James Steele, who's a captain special forces, who was sent into Iraq in 2003, 2004 to work with Shia militias. Mm. And they basically, galvanized this sectarian war against Sunnis. Horrific torture. They had detention chambers. They had detention camps. And he was, one of these special ops guys who had honed his skills in Latin America and Central America. And he was brought over. And The Guardian and Al Jazeera did amazing reporting. And it's something, and it's, that had a long-term effect on Shia Sunni relations.
Yes.
Because just Sunnis were just arbitrarily targeted young children brought in and tortured most horrific way. So basically these detention centers, including Abu Ghraib, became the gestation points for, a new set of insurgents who, out of desperation and righteous, anger, formed these new groupings, initially affiliated with Al-Qaeda or branches of it, and then branching off on their own and forming the Islamic State of Iraq. And then it became the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. And so, as immediately after Obama called, the end of combat, 2010, all of a sudden, these guys, are reemerge. They had been suppressed during these counterinsurgency campaigns by the U.S. and its new Iraqi partners. And then, and they expand in this vacuum, as you noted, this collapsed state, and they're able to expand. And as you remember, they had a huge state for, 3 or 4 years. Yeah. They controlled an area from Aleppo in Syria to large parts of Iraq, continuously. And they installed their own government and their own way of dealing with people. And they also carried out horrific campaigns against people they considered infidels, including the Yazidis, who they slaughtered and they enslaved women and, just horrific and genocidal conditions. And then, a concerted effort, Turkey, the U.S., the Iraqis, Kurdish militia in Syria, opposing groups, was able to force them back, confine them. I mean, they still haven't gone away. They're, still there somewhere. But they're no longer a force to be reckoned with. But now they're an international force.
Right.
So ISIS has branches and franchises all over the world, from Libya to the Philippines. They've carried out operations, in North America, in Europe, in Afghanistan. They're fighting the Taliban. So they're all over. So basically, what's happened, each one of these interventions has just created yet a new set of, and recruits too. So there are recruits from Uzbekistan, so the recruits from all over. So it's a sort of new emergence of these transnational Islamist movements, which have learned you know, these movements have learned their lesson, honed their skills,
exactly,
you know, in these endless U.S. wars.
Well, and in repeating, like, the U.S. proxy war in Afghanistan that first gave birth to, you know, an internationalist jihadi movement that then spread across the rest of the Islamic world, that Iraq then became a kind of central point for the recruitment and development of new groups wanting to fight, you know, the United States, and then being able to move on. And so this is bringing up, I think, some of the wider consequences, not only for Iraq, but of the region. You pointed out already in your remarks, you were alluding to the sectarianization of politics in Iraq that was exacerbated by this chaotic consequences of U.S. invasion. But of course, that sectarianism has been amplified and exacerbated in broader regional kinds of alignments in ways that maybe hadn't existed before. So I'm wondering what you think about, you know, the consequences in terms of Shia-Sunni sort of, you know, the way in which that has U.S. allies have essentially been on this kind of, you know, Sunni front and hyperbolically being concerned about the rise of Shi'i power, as it were, first in Iraq as a sort of, you know, satellite state of Iran, and of Iran's consequentially
Syria. Yeah,
that's right. That Iran, sometimes people talk about, well, Iran was the winner of the Iraq war, you know, because they have enhanced their, you know, reach in the region, and, you know, through these affiliates and friendly governments and so on. That's one component. And of course, the other component is what we were just talking about as well, of you know, the expansion of, you know, some of these internationalist jihadi groups, which is really the other side in some ways of that.
Yeah, Sunni guys. Yeah.
That's right.
But the thing is, the Americans walked in there, you know, and, you know, with their Orientalist, you know, the allies of Saddam Hussein are Sunni. We have the Sunni belt, you know, Fallujah's in the center of it. And these, you know, and so they deliberately went, you know, at a certain point, they threw in their lot with extremist Shia groups, who then exacerbated in the person of people like James Steele, you know, basically engineering, you know, conflict where it had, you know, their fault lines, but those fault lines don't become activated except for crisis and, you know, desperation and all sorts of other things, and then outside catalysts. And so, of course, the Iranians have been involved, and they're very involved now. And you know, Iraq is basically a proxy state, you know, with the United States and the Iranians, you know, fighting it out for eventual control, and the state moving this way and that way, and militias being very active, Iranian militias. But I have to say that Iranians have been a huge loser in the Iraq war. The Iranian right and the militarists have won. The expansionists have won. It was a reformist government that was in government at that time when the invasion happened. And basically, the U.S. invasion proved the right, you know, to be correct in their, perception of the West, that they want to overthrow the regime, that they're in Iraq, and we didn't discuss that, to check Iran. That was another, you know, regional goal. And so basically they destroyed any prospect there was for a sort of internal gradual reformist movement to arise in Iran. And the right wingers and militarists in Iran have taken control ever since. You know, there's been these small moments when they sort of gone back to sort of reformist government. But, you know, the U.S. has proved itself time and again to be, you know, untrustworthy and belligerent. And so it's very easy to make the case that, you know, you have to continually go on the offensive. And so Iraq basically, you know, destroyed the prospects for internal reform, at least up until this point. We don't know where this movement in Iran is going now, mm-hmm. but certainly, you know, democratic forces in Iraq too have been repressed by these Iranian militias. I mean, they're the ones who clamped down on, you know, horribly in 2019 on Iraqi protests, you know, against corruption, against failed institutions, against lack of jobs and, you know, infrastructure and electricity and everything else, you know. You know, they operate on both sides of the border now to repress workers, and, you know, all sorts of democratic forces.
Yeah. And so, also, I'm,
you know, I think the winners is the Iranian state, is the Iranian right, the state, right, and yes. the military.
That's Iranian right. Yeah. Military. Yeah. And also, of course, it also, enhances the argument for proliferation, you know, of, you know, a nuclear deterrent. I mean, why, you know, was Iraq, invaded? Why was it able to be invaded?
Yeah, exactly. Is,
you know, well, they don't have, you know, an actual deterrent, but, you know, you would never contemplate invading Pakistan under these circumstances. And maybe,
well, not now. Yeah.
Not now, you know. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, so that also had, I think, a consequence that it, you know, may have encouraged proliferation, at least as a bargaining chip in attempting to create some kind of, you know, and we did have the JCPOA, you know, for yeah. a period. But again, in the narrative that you've been pointing out, the United States continually, you know, proves
itself. Well, it's flip-flops. I mean, you know, the Obama, I mean, that could have been Obama's greatest achievement.
Yeah.
And, yeah. you know, is a peace with Iran. And he walked in, you know, with that Nowruz speech, you know, mm-hmm. we're celebrating mm-hmm. Nowruz now.
We're at Nowruz today,
yeah, basically. Nowruz Day. Yeah. And, you know, he walked in with that Nowruz speech and you really thought, okay, we're going to get someplace and finally we're going to put this hostage crisis behind us and 79 and everything else. And, you know, he was unable to follow through, you know, because he was being sabotaged by his own party, you know, by Democrats too, who were told by right-wing Israelis that there could be no peace with Iran and felt threatened by it. And so, yeah, I mean, I still think there could be distantly, not given the protests and stuff like that. I don't think, you know, there's going to be any, at least, you know, in this Biden administration, even though he's come around to, you know, a better relationship with Iran, if it was at all possible. But in the near future, it's not going to happen. But it certainly strengthens those people who want to move forward with, you know, going full nuclear mm-hmm. and having, you know, going past just, you know, having alternative sources of energy and yeah. actually enrichment programs.
Right. So, well, speaking of energy, yeah. and we had talked a little bit about, you know, the importance of control over the region's oil, not necessarily yeah. the use of those resources, but control over them. There are wider consequences of the Iraq war globally that we could look at, and maybe energy. You know, right now we're talking an awful lot about energy resources with the Ukraine war and, you know, cutting off of Russian natural gas, you know, the Nord Stream, you know, bombing attack and so on. So, you know, the energy resources and the geopolitical consequences of, you know, access to you know, energy reserves and so on is clearly very important in our own contemporary situation geopolitically. But of course, you know, there were a lot of big consequences for a period of time with the, you know, wars in the Middle East that skyrocketed the price of oil for a very long period of time before they softened sometime in the mid 2010s and so on. What do you think are some of the consequences on the global economy in terms of energy and environment of the Iraq war?
Okay. So, you know, in terms of, you know, the prices skyrocketed, but they've never come down to prices per barrel before the war, before True. 2003. So, right. you know, we in Canada are beneficiaries, if we can consider it that. I mean, the Canadian tar sands are beneficiaries because they don't turn a profit unless they reach a certain level because they're very expensive to produce and then, of course, enormously polluting. All oil producing countries have been beneficiaries, in effect, of belligerence and warfare that has pushed the price of oil up to, you know, well beyond what it was before 2003, at least in nominal terms. There are those consequences, Exxon Aramco just announced these obscene profits, billions and billions of dollars. So they're just raking in the money, but it's also the military that consumes enormous amounts of fossil fuels. And again, the costs of war in a subsequent study that Netta Crawford has completed is on the military's use of fossil fuels and the estimates of how much carbon has been pumped into the atmosphere from the military. I mean, planes just, a single plane, aircraft up in the air consumes, 1,000 cars put into the atmosphere over the course of a year. So, and the military is also very concerned about, the fuel and sourcing its equipment and everything else, but they're huge consumers of gas and, petroleum products. But I think the other side of this is that it's precisely these sort of crisis scenarios, these, endless wars and the incredible merging and fusing of the military-industrial complex with these projects secure and dominate regions that produce oil that has made it so incredibly ever more difficult to move ahead on the kind of transition to renewables that we must do. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, has just come out with a new report, same day as the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War, telling us again, but now in no uncertain terms, that we have a very finite window before we destroy the planet's environment in its entirety for all species, including our own. And that billions of people are already at grave risk of, imminent threats from climate change, whether it's flooding or droughts or starvation. We know we have millions of climate refugees already. So here we are 20 years later, and according to Netta Crawford and her colleagues, the U.S. alone has spent $18 trillion. And that includes the $800 billion that the Biden administration has just put forward for the budget for the Pentagon, this year's budget, right? So $18 trillion since 2003 for all of these wars. Meanwhile, the cost of conversion of the entire U.S. grid to renewables is $4.5 trillion, and it can be done within the window of the 7 years that we have left before basically we face not a climate crisis, but a climate holocaust. We've lost time. I think the global impact of the war, this was set the 21st century on a collision course with our future and our fate as a planet. We've wasted 20 years. And the failure to engage with international law, the defiance of international law, the fact that after 9/11, actually the whole world was on the side of the United States. Everyone wanted to help the United States. Russia opened up, airfields in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan.
That's right.
It's just unthinkable the level of cooperation that there was. That was all squandered. That whole moment of trust, so many things could have been done, and it was squandered. And basically the US and the neocons and the neolibs just spit in the face of the world and said, we're going to be this chief superpower. We don't care what you do, and we're going to take advantage of your goodwill and we're going to exploit it. So they destroyed trust They undermined international institutions. They squandered the world's resources, because we can scarcely say those $18 trillion are just American resources. They're not just, I mean, those resources, those money got squeezed out of the entire planet, you know, through corporations and consumption and everything else. They're not just taxpayer dollars. And so, you know, we squandered 20 years. We've destroyed trust. And we have this shrinking window in which to transform the world's energy sources. And meanwhile, we have, you know, the military-industrial complex and the fossil fuel industry just completely hand in glove and fighting this whole thing, you know, every step of the way. I think last but not least, we have to say that what happened in Iraq and as it unfolded has made possible the war in Ukraine. It's really, you know, the way that the neocons, and they're neocons who were part of the Bush administration, that are still in the Biden administration, that were in the Obama administration, and they have been determined to provoke Russia. And they're still there provoking Russia. They provoked Russia in Ukraine, and the Russians were quite aware of what was going on, which is not in any way to say that Putin or any regime in Russia has a right to invade Ukraine, to occupy it, to commit crimes of war, to destroy cities and everything that's going on. There's no excuse for that. But provocation there was. And the provocation wasn't Ukrainian. It had to do with the US. And there was also a failure and just a cynicism about, you know, if the US can undertake preemptive war in a country that's halfway around the world, you know, and claim its, you know, threat to its you know, sovereignty and security, then of course, you know, Russia can claim the same thing and has. It's using the same language that Bush used. And don't forget, Bush and Vladimir, George W.
He
and
looked
Vladimir
into his eyes
at one time. Yeah,
that's
they're,
right.
They're
he looked into his eyes
in Crawford, Texas. You know, they were hanging out. They liked each other. So, you know, quoting his old buddy, you know, is, you know, Ukraine now has weapons of mass destruction. Ukraine poses a security threat, you know, existential threat to Russia. And then, of course, the other palabra that, you know, the Putin regime lays on top of its excuses. But I think it's the undermining of international institutions. It's the impunity, and we talked about that at the beginning, the impunity for committing crimes of war. I mean, and the most serious crime, we forget this. We talk about what happened on September 11, 2001. It's this huge crime of war. Yes, it was a crime against humanity, but it was not a crime against peace because it was not carried out by a government. It was carried out by a rogue actor. And when we weigh, you know, how many thousands of people have died, hundreds of thousands of people have died, against those people who died in the World Trade Center, and you and I were both in New York City on that day, and it was horrible, and it was incredibly tragic, and there was practically no survivors from the Twin Towers, right? But all total, we're talking about 2,000 human beings. And only a small part of New York City was destroyed. And by consequence, we've destroyed at least two countries, Iraq and Syria, right? Iraq, Syria, three countries.
Right.
Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria.
Well, don't forget Libya.
In Libya, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people have been slaughtered. Entire countries have been reduced to rubble and are basically non-functioning states.
Nearly 40 million people were displaced as refugees.
Yes, we have millions of people who are displaced, who've been turned into refugees. There's just no equivalence in this. And it all goes back to that somehow we legitimize the actions of states, even when they're criminal. We cannot bring ourselves to say that you know, these people who engineered this are criminals, and the action itself was a crime against the peace, and in many ways, the most serious crime. And it's brought us to the point where we face two possibilities of annihilation, mm-hmm. which is nuclear war, which is really on the table. We're really close, according to any serious scholar who looks at what's going on in Ukraine. We are, you know, and the expansion of NATO that's going on, and environmental Holocaust on the other side.
Yeah.
And these are the 20 years we've squandered. We haven't just squandered them. We've made it almost impossible to address those existential threats that face us, which we should be getting rid of nuclear weapons, which we should have done at the end of the Cold War, which never happened, and addressing exactly at the same moment what we knew to be the existential threat of the climate disaster.
One can say that the cost of war has truly been incalculable.
Incalculable. Yeah. And it's made the 21st century. It was the Iraq War that made the century we're living in.
Yeah. Well, Ariel, on that somber note, I want to thank you very much for all of your thoughtful analysis and considerations about you know, what has been wrought as a result of the Iraq War and the opportunity cost that is so serious. Maybe before you go, is there any other lessons that you would want to draw out about, you know, response or resistance to this at this moment? I recall that 20 years ago, the largest protests really perhaps in the history of the world were mobilized globally.
36 million people worldwide.
Yeah. And the New York Times even ran an article saying that there is a second superpower, you know, and it is global public opinion. Unfortunately, it wasn't capable of stopping the war at that time. But, you know, if we want to think about the consequences, or at least what was possible, the world was mobilized. The U.S. didn't listen. But, I mean, that itself is something that could be built upon if we were to be able to recover some sense of that global humanity and rebuild that sense of trust. Even if these institutions have been undermined by states, there is, you know, the solidarity of people who are struggling, you know, for a just and equitable world.
And we have to bring together those two movements, and they haven't been together. We have to bring the environmental movement and the anti-war movement. They're both movements for life, for freedom, for justice, and we have to bring them together, and they should be in a conversation, and they haven't been, and they weren't, you know. They were sort of, you had people demonstrating at one but not at the other. And so I think it's time we bring that whole movement together, that the disarmament movement, the peace movement, and the environmental movement have to be one movement for a human livable future.
Absolutely. Well, listeners, I think you have a lot to think about through the context of thinking about 20 years since the Iraq War. And with that final advice from Dr. Ariel Salzman, we thank you very much, Ariel.
Thank you, Adnan.
And listeners, look for new episodes coming soon on the Mudgeless. So check out the feed, subscribe to the podcast, share it with your friends. I think you're getting here in the conversation today and the expertise of Dr. Salzman, you know, a view and analysis that you're not going to find on a lot of other venues. So do share it with friends. And until next time, salam, and be well. Peace to everyone.
Thank you for joining us in the Mejlis, a podcast by MSGP. Muslim Society's Global Perspectives, or MSGP, is an initiative at Queen's University dedicated to connecting the complex history of Islamic societies with the contemporary world. You can connect, learn more, and support us by checking out our website, www.queensu.ca/msgp and stay up to date with our events by following us on Twitter at msgpqu and on our Facebook, msgpqu. You can also follow our YouTube channel, The Medj List.